Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the whole crew here, Jacob Cantle, Lauren Gibbons, Craig Mauger, and John Rurink. Happy New Year to everybody, the first podcast of 2015.
Happy New Year, woo!
We're starting off on the right foot. Lauren's drinking very healthy over here. No. She's got some concoction in a glass that is green and color.
It's also disgusting. It's also the like worst grass. Smoothie ever.
It's actually separating now. There's a type of fog on the bottom.
Tell us what it is. It's spinach, banana.
And milk.
Oh, wow. That sounds really yummy.
It sounds really disgusting. Well,
can I try some of it? Here, let me try some of this thing.
You can shut it.
Okay.
It's a blender.
All right. Okay. Oh. Well, it's not that bad. What are you talking about? It just doesn't have any taste to it.
It's terrible.
It just doesn't taste.
We didn't get Kyle spitting something up on the podcast.
All right. So, anyway, 2015 here. 2014's in the rearview mirror. Looking ahead now to 2015, the talk around Lansing is that this is going to be a more conservative legislature than the one that we had in 2013-14. Craig, we'll start with you. Agree or disagree?
I agree with that in theory here. I think the leadership of the House and the Senate are going to be more conservative than the previous leadership. Look at Medicaid expansion, for example, in the House. Most of the House Republican leadership coming in didn't vote for that, while previously the House leadership did vote for it. And then look at some of the bills that deal with the strategic fund. I think that's one of the really interesting things, like film credits, extending the sunset on the 21st Century Jobs Fund. The House leadership coming in voted against these bills. The old House leadership put these bills up for a vote. So, I think those are two bright areas that you can highlight.
You know, you take a look, too, at there's a lot of talk about the new three conservative Republicans who are coming in, Cindy Gamrat, Todd Corser, Gary Glenn. But you can also say that some of the more conservative members that the House did have, like Bob Gonetsky, are going to be gone. So you have this natural flushing out. And sometimes the people coming in are more conservative, and sometimes they're not.
And there's also a lot of moderate Republicans coming in as well, which I think will be an interesting dynamic in terms of the Republicans won in some seats where their members are going to have to operate in a moderate fashion because they're representing Democratic-leaning districts or really swing districts. And then you have these Republicans coming in, like Gary Glenn, Todd Corser, and Cindy Gamrat, who kind of, unlike Bob Gonetsky, rose through like the conservative grassroots and are really viewing part of their service in Lansing as representing the Tea Party grassroots of the Republican Party.
And then over in the Senate, Lauren, just taking a look over there, you see who's departing, and then you wonder, are they more conservative than the people that they're replacing? I'm thinking Dale Zorn, Randy Richardville, Ken Horn, Roger Kahn.
Right. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, it's kind of interesting because the dynamic is probably not going to shift too much, like on a senator-by-senator level. The level of conservatism is relatively similar in most of those changeovers. Over districts. I think, as Craig mentioned, the leadership is where it will really get a little bit more conservative.
Also, looking ahead to 2014, Craig, you and I were talking about House members to watch going into this upcoming session. The freshmen who are going to have most likely the impact. Now, this is just our first impressions of looking at the various people we've talked to, all but two of the incoming freshmen. We got 44 in all, I guess 43. Holly Hughes technically isn't a freshman. She's coming back for her second term. But on the Republican side, here are some people that we focused out. Laura Cox, the Wayne County Commissioner, who was the head of the budget for the Wayne County Commission, despite being the only Republican on that board. Pretty impressive feat over there. Also, Lana Tice. Now, Lana Tice can get pigeonholed as being part of this Tea Party conservative movement. However, she's got some very impressive credentials. She actually was the chair of a statewide ballot committee only a few years ago. She's a local treasurer. People like Brian Calley are very high on her. So I think Lana Tice has to be in this conversation. Then on also Daniela Garcia. She is a former staffer to Pete Hoekstra. I think she's going to bring a lot of policy experience to the table and is somebody who I think this caucus is going to look toward for some policy ideas. You know, and I know that this next one here gets kind of grouped in with this this whole Tea Party group, but Gary Glenn, I think, is somebody that we got to keep an eye on. You know, Gary Glenn has a wide, diverse background in various policy issues, and I think he's going to surprise some people here. You know, when Tom McMillan was brought into the House, folks kind of feared the worst. What is Tom McMillan going to bring to the legislature? And I think there were some folks who were pleasantly surprised with his focus on government transparency and FOIA reform. He really brought a keen interest to that. And I think we might see something similar from Gary Glenn. I don't know what particular policies we're going to see maybe different than what we would expect, but I think we're going to see some different things out of Gary Glenn. And then the last one out of the Republican side, Eric Lutheiser out of Hillsdale. He's the former car dealership owner for the past 30 years. He's also interned for a member of Congress in the past. So somebody I think also to keep an eye on. Now, I'm going to make this guess here, Craig, and you know you can agree or disagree, but I think history has shown that I think the next leader of the House Republican Caucus will come from this freshman class. If you look at who the second termers are going to be this year, I don't think that they've got the numbers to necessarily pick next year's leader or the leader for the 2017-2018 session. So I think if the Republicans hold majority in the next election cycle, I think the next Speaker of the House is going to come from this freshman class. That's just an early prediction. Let's go over to the Democrats here, Craig. Four people who I think that we're going to keep an eye on: Stephanie Chang out of Detroit, a community activist who is actually very active during the November campaign, not necessarily for her election because that was pretty much in the bag after the August primary, but keeping active in the Democratic circles I thought was very interesting. I think she's going to be extremely active succeeding Rashida Tlaib in that 6th district in Detroit. John Hoadley also is no stranger to Kalamazoo or elected politics. He led a successful ballot initiative down there, and he's going to bring a lot of energy to the Democratic caucus. I expect to see a lot from him. And also Jeremy Moss, a former longtime staffer for Paul Condino, Brenda Lawrence, Rudy Hobbs. He obviously knows the ropes. He knows what's going on, and I would expect him to be extremely active. And then the last one on the Democratic side, Christine Gregg, who's been a business professional for about 20 years or so, I think has a business background that I think the Democratic caucus may end up relying on, and I would expect to see some things out of her. So just out of this freshman class, first blush, some people who kind of caught our eye as we went and interviewed all the different incoming House members. Well, John Ruhrink and I were able to speak with the governor for several minutes right before the Christmas holiday. We published some of his comments earlier, but there's a good part of this interview that we saved for this podcast, including his position on fracking and airline fuel. And we also touched on government transparency. How come he hasn't been able to get more done from his white paper on that? Let's listen to his comments on that. Well, John's got the first one.
Okay. Is a promise to Michigan voters that you'll be their governor in 2018, barring any unforeseen health issues, something you can agree to?
Wow. What I view is the whole thing about pledges and promises, I'm not sure that's the best way to operate. So, and I've been very consistent about that on most any topic. What I would say is it's great being governor of Michigan. I'm excited. I just got reelected, and I didn't start all the speculation. So it's one of those things with 2016, it's interesting. They've got dozens of people they have on their list. Mm-hmm. I think that is a fair statement that people ask me. I think the governors are the best candidates. So, and the third piece that ties into that is I think we should be promoting Michigan more. Not in terms of being a candidate, but we've done so many great things. We should be telling the rest of the world about the great stuff we're doing, not in the context of a campaign, but it would be good for job creation in our state.
For you, there's been talk in the past about a voter initiative to ban fracking in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Some speculate that might come up again in 16. If it does, is that something you'd work actively for or against?
Well, we've been fracking wells in Michigan for years and years. We've fracked over 10,000 wells in the state of Michigan without any really environmental problem. Serious problem. I said that once, and somebody found one problem with some permit or something, so on one.
So you would pose a ban on fracking?
Well, again, to ban it doesn't make any sense when we've been successfully doing it in a smart way. And I actually called for this in my environmental message a couple years ago, is we actually went out and we've been working with the University of Michigan on looking at the future of fracking and how to be proactive in our regulatory scheme to make sure we're being responsible. Because when I say we frack so many wells, John, fracking has continued to go more horizontal and deeper and doing some variations. So what we've done just isn't good enough, in my view. I want to make sure that we are being environmentally responsible. So my view is, so let's be among the most proactive on having smart regulation to be responsible.
Have you ever made any commitments that you would not sign a prevailing wage elimination bill?
Wow, that's an interesting question.
Yeah, I know.
In terms of public commitments, no.
Yeah, I don't think so. Not public. I haven't heard one. How about in talking with legislators? Have you ever told a legislator, I will not sign a prevailing wage elimination?
Well, if it was private and I told you, it wouldn't be private
anymore.
Well,
I didn't say it was private. I just asked if you asked legislators. Let me do a Tim Scudic here, and I'm going to ask this question a different way. What's your position on prevailing wage? Is this good policy for Michigan?
In terms of prevailing wage, I haven't spent any real time on prevailing wage. I tell you, it wasn't on my agenda, but that always gets people smiling now.
Okay, so
it's not been a priority.
Okay, all right.
In 2010, you said there was a dysfunctional government culture in Lansing. That's a quote. Do you still feel that way?
No, I think we've got a culture that's been successful. I think there's always room to improve, but it was dysfunctional. And the representations I would give you is budget shutdowns 2 of the 3 years before I took office. That's not healthy. I'm having an environment where many of the employees that are great, hardworking people, their main date they knew was retirement date. That's not a good answer.
Okay. When we looked at your old white papers, we found one subject where your accomplishments were not as plentiful, and that was on transparency.
You guys do good research.
We keep those babies.
We do.
I can show you my list.
Well, yeah. It's an issue.
No way. Does it really have them?
Oh, you better believe it.
Oh, look at that. This is awesome.
There it is.
All right. Excellent. So this is...
Here's a summary of all the white papers, and here's the notes I made.
So we bring up transparency because... As you know, in the election, there was a fair amount of money that came in that wasn't publicly trackable.
Yeah.
Is that something you would like to see, or would like to do more on in the next 4 years?
Again, this is where I learned the lesson from the famous Nerd Fund about disclosure, so that was part of it. One of the big ones that I'll be open with, I'll give you one piece that other people don't have at this point that I'm going to emphasize or go after again is the fiscal note question. That's in that section.
Fiscal note.
Yeah, when people do bills about being more responsible. On the whole topic of other disclosures, I'm open to having that discussion with people. I haven't found a lot of support for those things, generally. So it's one of those things that when I didn't get anybody wanting to work with me very much, it just was time to move on. Yeah. But I do keep them alive, as you see. I take this stuff seriously, so over the holidays, I'll be going back through that and roughing that out as part of the next 4 years.
Do you have any feelings on any reforms to redraw Michigan's legislative districts, how we go about the process of doing the legislative redistricting? Do you have any thoughts at all on how that's done, if that could be done better?
I'm open-minded to that. I haven't spent a lot of time myself on it. I understand the issue that other places have done that.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'd say is that's not something I'm actively working at this point, because the things I'm actively working are, one, going back through this list in some ways to make an assessment of what is doable after 4 years of experience in terms of being effective, and then the key priorities being the career tech education, the skilled trade thing that I've talked about a lot, education, the third grade reading and before, and then the intersection between high school and higher ed are the two education pieces that stand out. In addition, I would say the Detroit situation. So three educational pieces in particular. Good government, which would in particular be continuing the budgets, continuing the pay down of debt, but then the local partnership question that I want to be much more proactive. Again, it's how do you avoid the emergency major? What can we do on better accountability and transparency with municipalities and schools? And looking at some of those long-term structural questions. I think that's a pretty good outline of big stuff to go after. Energy policy.
Yeah, you mentioned third grade reading. Do you think that kids, if they can't read proficiently at the third grade level, should be held back until they can read?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
The issue there is I think it's been successful in other states, but it was more a function of they included it in their package but they did a lot of investment to help people be successful by third grade, if you follow me. Because one of the concerns I get is people just say, we want to hold people back. Well, that doesn't do you any good if you haven't done a lot of intensive or focused investment to actually help people be successful by third grade.
Right.
So the point of holding someone back for the point of holding them back.
At a time when you're asking motorists to pitch in $1.2 billion more in resources for roads, is it a good time to roll back the sales and use tax on airline fuel, aviation, gasoline?
What I would say is that topic comes up, and one of the challenges is what's driving that in some ways is we have an issue with the FAA about the use of aviation-related fuel taxes. So if you look at it, we sort of have a conflict potentially between our Constitution saying that extra 2% goes to education and the FAA saying it goes to aviation. So one of the questions I'm spending some time is looking at how do you can you reconcile those two, or what are the options to address that in some fashion?
If it weren't for the legislative requirement that you do so, would you have...
that's trouble right there.
I think you're talking... This is not England or something.
I'm trying to find out what question he's going to ask.
Where's this one going?
Would you have on your own pursued a private prison food contract?
What I would say is that was a legislative requirement.
It was. But if it weren't there, would you
and
have
pursued
this issue?
And so I did what my partners told me I needed to do.
This has been a pain in the rear end, hasn't it? I mean, really, it's been more trouble than it's been worth.
It's been a significant effort, to go through this process. Because, I think we've done a good job in corrections, and a lot of people don't appreciate, we've made a lot of significant cuts to corrections while still maintaining what I call good public safety and safety for the officers and for public. And one of the reasons the budget number hasn't declined significantly more is because we're now funding benefits and retirements appropriately that shows up in their budget line. So it's one of those misnomers when people say nothing's happened. A lot has happened. We're just doing it in a more responsible fashion.
Is the creation of suspicion-based drug testing for welfare recipients an unfair targeting of the poor?
Not necessarily. My biggest concern is, at first they were going to have it apply to the first time somebody got tested.
Right.
And I thought that was inappropriate. Because my point is if someone's got a substance abuse problem, we shouldn't penalize them. We should help them solve their substance abuse problem. Beyond that, if they continue to abuse substances because they won't get help or they have other issues, that's the point of the pilot is, let's see what the consequences are and how we can manage through that in some fashion.
How many changes do you see making in your second term with your top shelf administration?
Not a lot.
Really?
I mean, we've had the couple announced retirements. Again, there could be a couple more, but the good part is I'm really proud of this group. And a lot of the folks, when they first came, said they were coming for a year, 2 years, and almost everybody stayed for all four.
Yeah.
And the good part is a lot of people are fired up to keep going. Because, again, this is an awesome group. I mean, this is the best group of people I've ever worked with. I always use the two criteria to measure it on. One is we have open discussion where people can share things. And you know this, if you go off the record, that people have told me I'm nuts.
I'm sure.
And I've had a good chunk of them tell me I'm nuts in the same meeting.
That's a good headline.
But on the other hand, it's a great group that once a decision's made, and again, I don't force decisions on people, but once a decision's made, we don't have people doing the backdoor stuff or the behind-the-scenes thing to sabotage decisions. They support it. And that's a great environment. I mean, I worked in the private sector. I worked in a lot of different places, and you can't say that about most places people work to the degree we can here. And that's really proud, especially given the environment.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to the whole crew here, Dave Murray and Sarah Werfel, for getting us some time with the governor, and also the Michigan Press Association for sending out this podcast far and wide. Until next week's edition, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.